This episode contains spoilers for 1997's The Big Lebowski, as well as some strong language, dude. But if you're okay with spoiling a 20-plus-year-old movie, as well as okay with taking a warm, candle-lit bath with a tweezer-held joint and listening to whale sounds, then please, enjoy the show. All right, I know it's been a week since we did our episode on Crazy Stupid Love, but, you know, I still think Steve Carell can really only play like one type of comedic role that he just changes slightly for all of his movies and TV shows.
Yeah, well, that's just like your opinion, man.
Shit. You got me. All right, well, that was a very easy intro, and we're going to be doing an easy episode here. This is a very laid-back podcast, man. Because
yeah, man.
We are doing this podcast the right way. We've got our stoner hoodies on that we bought in California. We've got sunglasses on. It's a great time. And what are we doing on this show? What is this show? Please introduce us, man, because I'm too laid back to introduce us.
Well, fuck it. No. Yeah, so I guess I'll be the one to introduce the show. This is Movie Mixology, a show where we have drinks that appear in movies and also are inspired by movies. This week, we just so happen to be doing...
Wait, what the fuck was that, man? I mean, this is part of the problem, man.
This will not stand.
This aggression will not stand.
You stole my line. I was going to say that. There's too many good quotes in this movie.
There really is. What my esteemed co-host, Marissa, I'm Pat, meant to say was that we enjoy both. Very, very greatly. And...
Oh, I forgot about that, man.
I know you did, man. So, you know what? Let's just move on. Let's get past it. And
I really think you need to chill out, man.
It's not Saturday, so I don't have to observe.
This is very undude-like.
Yeah, you're right. And that's because I'm not the dude yet. But as I alluded to last time, that's my ultimate goal. Okay, so back on track. We are, of course, the hosts of Movie Mixology. And this week, as Marissa said, we are doing The Big Lebowski. And wow, that's just all I can say. Wow, we've got so many requests for this show, to do this film, and specifically to do the drink that I'm holding in my hand right now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this drink, Marissa?
This is the Caucasian, also known as the White Russian.
Yeah. Nice Caucasian.
Yeah, it's really good. It tastes, because of the Kahlua, because of the Kahlua, the coffee liqueur, the cream, the half and half, and the vodka. Patrick will get into specifics later. because of all that, it actually tastes a lot like an iced coffee, you know, with some vanilla flavoring in it. So these things are pretty dangerous. But in terms of where this appears in the movie, it's in pretty much every scene of the movie.
this might be the most times that we've done on one of the episodes where the drink appears like the most times in a film.
Yeah.
It really is like a huge part.
It cracks me up because, like, you know, he makes it in his apartment, right? And I think he uses liquid half and half. And then when he makes it at Maud's place, he, you know, she obviously doesn't have that. So he uses like the powdered half and half. And then, you know, he asks at the porn guy's house for him to make him one.
Jackie Treehorn.
Yeah, that ends up getting spiked, but he makes him one. So he just drinks some, and he's drinking it in the taxi cab.
Yep.
Or I mean the limo.
The limo.
When he's being interrogated by the Big Lebowski, and he sees the toe. So this movie is just part, or this drink is part of the movie. And so this really was a good one for you guys to request. And I love the enthusiasm, as Patrick was saying, about how many people we got that requested this movie. It's such a fun movie. It's so quotable, as we said. And this drink is just awesome. So Patrick, specifically, if you want to say, I mean, I pretty much already said all the ingredients, but if you want
to... Well, yeah, for those who like to write down our recipes or try them themselves, the recipe officially is calling for, you know, one part vodka, one part Kahlua or coffee liqueur. It just so happens we see Kahlua a lot in the movie and we want it to be movie accurate. And then heavy cream is typically what's used as the...
Heavy cream or half and half?
Well, it's typically, I've seen heavy cream on most recipes, but we want it to be movie accurate. Oh. So we used half and half because that's what the dude buys in the very first scene of the film, you know? And even though it costs 67 cents, he still has to write a check for it. and so our recipe that we made was straight out of our book by Robin M. Feller, which calls for 1.5 ounces of vodka, 1.5 ounces. We use Kahlua or some other coffee liqueur, and then you float heavy cream to the top. And you're right, it tastes like a nice coffee, and it's very, very, very tasty. I can see why the dude likes them almost to an excessive amount.
We were trying to be a movie accurate, and instead of using heavy cream, we used half and half.
Exactly. So... very tasty and very dude-ish to be drinking it here in our stoner hoodies. So that's about it for our intro here. Let's get into the three things that we absolutely have to talk about with the Big Lebowski. And, you know, three doesn't even begin to scratch the surface with this movie, which is probably studied in film school at this point. But we're going to try in our first segment, Triple Shot.
It's time for Triple Shot.
All right, Marissa, since I went first last time, your turn. What is your first shot about the Big Lebowski?
Okay, so my first shot is going to be about how much I love the idea that this movie builds its story around a character rather than the plot, or putting the plot first. So I think that the plot in this movie is great. It's like a lot of noir films and books, you could draw a lot of comparisons, but this story is unique because you have a very interesting character in the dude, and that is the focal point, that is the center, and I feel like it was written around his character of like, what if we plopped this character into a noir kind of story, and you know, we made this our own sort of thing. And I just love that because some of the best books, I think, any type of media that's, you know, like a book, movie, a TV show, in my opinion, some of the best ones start with the character first, because if you don't have a compelling character, an interesting character, you know, the plot's not going to help you. So I think that the fact that this is really heavily focused on the dude from the very beginning, you see how unique the dude is, and you know, you see him paying with a check at the grocery store for milk at the grocery store with a check, and you know, you get him in his whole outfit and everything from the very beginning. I think it's super refreshing because you just get this sense of how this movie is about this character, and I feel like that doesn't happen a whole lot in movies anymore. A lot of times movies are very much plot driven or franchise driven rather than character driven. Whereas when I think of this movie, I think of the dude.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, he's so emblematic of not only this like time period that the movie is set in and the time that the movie was like released in, but he's also just this really charismatic character. I mean, everything about him is like, you just kind of want to hang out with this guy. And I think that just speaks to the Jeff Bridges performance, which is so, he's so enraptured and so realized in this character that he eventually becomes this person in real life. Like this, I feel like his real life persona soon became a version of this dude. And it's really interesting to look back at movies Jeff Bridges made before 1997, before The Big Lebowski, you know, stuff like Tron or L.A. Confidential, you know, all these other movies that ranged, have a wide range from like, you know, family movies, crime dramas, whatever, you know, comedies. And then to see how he just kind of plays this really like person that you, I feel like we all know a person somewhat like this, and maybe not to this exaggerated amount, but I think that's just speaking to exactly what you said, that the Coens love to do that. The Coen brothers films have such an incredible realization of their characters that absurd things can happen in the world around them. Surreal moments can happen that would never happen in real life, but you don't really care because their characters are so well grounded.
And something that I think that is great about his character specifically, like you were saying that is he's from a specific time period and everything, is that, you know, you kind of get the sense that the dude is a satirization of, you know, many people, I guess, who live in California. And that might be an oversimplification because I really get a sense from the movie that the dude is not just like, while it's his character is satirical, it's also kind of like there's a lot of love for his character in the movie. Like, you know, it's built in there of like, yeah, we're satirizing this and we're making fun of this, but we're also kind of showing a lot of love toward this kind of person.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's like part of the charisma. And people will do things for him throughout the movie because he's just, you know, he's just not a harm to anybody. And I think that's kind of what the character wants to be. He just wants to be left to his own devices, to live his own life, to just be a free spirit. And as a result, nobody really sees him as like an overt threat or, in Walter's case, so, you know, Walter sees him as a guy that he needs to help, probably has his own things he's working on there, but he's always available, even when the dude doesn't want him there, which is just a really great character dynamic. So that's actually a great segue into my first shot, which is how the dude, I think, also is an incredible representation of anonymity. Gosh, it's funny. We were just watching a QAnon documentary, and I don't think the dude would be on 4chan, you know, posting all up on the boards. But I think that he represents people that just are not super special, right? Like, he represents people that are ordinary but gets thrust into extraordinary situations, which is something that the Coens love to explore, right? If you look at their filmography, you know, just some of their greatest films, Fargo, No Country for Old Men, you know, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, right? It's, you know, just to name a few, it's people that are very, very based on like real life people that like are representations of other people or like pastiches, you know, collages of real life people or groups of people. But they get put in these extraordinary situations and you kind of have to reckon with, oh, how would I respond in that situation? Like, I kind of get where they're coming from, right? I kind of understand why the dude is not willing to answer this phone, or he's like going to flee the scene of the crime, or why he's like, oh, I need to get my car back for the $1 million that was left in it. You kind of understand all those motivations. And I think that that's on purpose because there's so many people that have, you know, not a whole lot of, you know, he doesn't even have a job, right? He's just kind of going through life. And there are a lot of people that's how they choose to live their best life, so to speak. And I think that that's really cool. But it goes to show that, you know, sometimes that can have people underestimate you. if you are living in that way where you don't really seem to have ambition on your on the surface, it could be a misleading feature that has people underestimate your intelligence. And I think the dude is actually a very intelligent guy, right? You know, through little clues and little contexts that you can pick up, and I've picked up on a few of them on this rewatch, we learn that, you know, he went to college. When he first meets Brandt and the Big Lebowski, he finesses a rug, you know, just like walks out without any sort of fight. He's able to cleverly get a rug out of it. I love that he writes a 67 cent check in the very first scene. I think that's just iconic stuff. And then, you know, he continues to show like all these other things, like when he's talking with Maude in the scene after they have sex, right? And he's kind of like talking to her about his life. And he's like, you know, you ever heard of this Seattle 7? That was me. There were also six other people, I think. And he's ultimately able to solve the mystery of Lebowski on his own and uncover the conspiracy, if you will, of Lebowski, the Big Lebowski's like plot to try and get rid of his wife that he's estranged to, he's become estranged to, all by himself. But he's not able to do anything about it, which is like kind of the point, right? It's kind of what the Coens are getting at, that, you know, this guy, for all of his worth and all of his powers and prowess, can't really affect any change or really amount to very much, and is just ultimately stuck in this like kind of just dream fugue state, right? You know,
his bubble bath.
He's stuck in his bubble baths, exactly. He's stuck in his bowling music videos featuring Saddam Hussein as a bowling clerk. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like he's caught in a dream, in a trip, and I think that that's definitely on purpose, and it's very indicative of like all the rest of the stuff the Coens do, and I love it so much.
Yeah, I wonder if the question then, like, you know, you said you're supposed to kind of note how he is intelligent and he does figure out all of these things. And someone even thinks he's a private eye, like another private eye thinks that he's a private eye.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately, the dude doesn't want to be involved in any of this. He doesn't want to do anything other than just chill out and hang out. And, you know, he gets criticized by the Big Lebowski for his lifestyle, you know, who's a representation of, you know,
bum.
Yeah, people who would call him a bum. And, you know, of course, the Big Lebowski is a fraud himself, or is a fraud. Whereas the dude is not a fraud. The dude is very much just himself. He's just doing his thing. And he's not hurting anyone, like you said. And I think, I wonder then if the ultimate question is like, yeah, the dude really can't, you know, I guess make waves in society or anything like that with his lifestyle, but maybe that's okay because that's what he wants. He just wants to like hang out and you know, I guess just have friends and be friends and make
drink white Russians and smoke weed
and try to, you know, he does nice things here and there. Like he tries to tell Walter to be nicer to Donnie, you know, yep. At the very beginning, he says like, or not Donnie, he tells him to be nicer to that other guy they're bowling with who's a pacifist. I forget his name, but the guy who's...
Oh, yeah, where he's like, it's a league game.
Yeah, he tells him, like, you know, you need to be nicer to that guy. He has a lot of emotional issues. So the dude kind of... And the dude is friends with, like, people of all different, you know, spectrums, I guess, and the dude doesn't even really care. He's just like... Spectrums meaning like different political ideologies, different life ideologies. But the dude's just like, you know what? We're all human. You know, it's like, let's just hang out. And I think that's a big part of what gives his character so much charm because, you know, as the audience, you're supposed to question what we perceive as a quote bum. And if that's really such a bad thing, you know, if in the long run, if this person is just going around, you know, sort of doing his own thing and living his life.
I couldn't agree more. So what is your second shot?
So my second shot is, we kind of already got into this a little bit, but I love how this movie casually just starts discussing a bunch of philosophies and people's personal philosophies, ideologies, religions. So within this one movie, we get a discussion of pacifism, nihilism. We basically get the dude's ideology, which is kind of like just this laid back.
They're not Nazis. Yeah. They're nihilists. Oh, okay. Nothing to worry about.
We get sort of religious discussions, like what does it mean to be Jewish? Like if your wife was Jewish and so you converted and then you got divorced, are you still Jewish? Like, you know, we get that kind of discussion. We get discussions about, you know, people's different political viewpoints, even like Walter's First Amendment rights, you know, thing. And so this movie just kind of covers a wide range of, and of course the Big Lebowski, who believes completely in like, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, capitalism, that sort of thing. That's at least what he says outwardly is what everybody needs to do.
Right.
And so I think that that's very interesting for this movie, which is so funny and got, you know, that kind of attitude to it, that, you know, on such a deeper level, and it's really, you know, these things are actually talked about and made into jokes that, but on a deeper level that they're actually discussing, you know, different people's philosophies in a way that aren't always discussed in real life or in these kind of situations, but it seems like very natural. Like all the nihilism jokes crack me up.
Right. People aren't, I don't think in real life, as outwardly expressive of those thoughts and those deeper, you know, ideologies, like you said. I think that the fact that they are doing that, though, is like really funny because it adds to the surrealist nature of like the movie, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that these people are so outward about this stuff. And it's funny because I feel like the people in real life who are the most outward about their philosophy are a lot like the dude. Mm-hmm. They're very just, I believe in you know, insert X ideal here, but I express that by being a free spirit and my truest self. Mm-hmm. And the dude's uncompromisedness, I think, is funny because he just, you know, he's only encountering people that are also very outwardly expressive of their ideas, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, that's very true. Every character in this movie, I think, if you can't say anything like about them, other, like the one thing you can say, I guess, that ties all of them together, because all of the characters in this movie are so, I would say, drastically different from each other, really, in their ideological viewpoints, in their personalities, everything. Like you said, they're outwardly expressive of their own individual ideas, and they're authentically themselves. They're not hiding who they are. Like you said, the dude's not hiding who he is. Walter is certainly not hiding who he is, bringing out a gun in the bowling alley. Maude is not hiding.
Am I the only one around here?
Yeah, Maude is not hiding who she is. Her artist, nude artist self.
Bearing it all.
Yeah, I mean, nobody hides who they are in this movie. Bunny doesn't. She's like, do you want to have, like, I'll perform a sex act on you? Like, nobody's hiding who they are. And, you know, some people might say, well, this movie's just full of caricatures, but I don't think so. I think this movie is literally just filled with people who are like, this is who I am. I'm putting everything out on the table. And maybe that's, you know, a point that they're trying to make, is like this cast of characters that the dude encounters. He is able to kind of put the story together and figure everything out because, you know, he knows who everyone in this movie is. You know, he knows who everyone around him is about. Yes.
Right. I think that that's one of the things that struck me the most on this watch, is everybody is just, you know, I think they are caricatures, but they are very vibrant, like very, your character motivations are not at all hidden, which is so interesting for a crime drama, right? Or like in this case, a crime dark comedy, right? Where I feel like that whole genre is, especially noir, like we alluded to earlier, and there's definitely noir influences in this movie, are predicated on, you don't know all the characters ever. You don't know all the motivations until the last shot, right? You know, and that's like part of the mystery, part of the stuff. But on this one, it's like, he's able to uncover a mystery that was like hiding in plain sight. And I think that that is like really effective, because you're like, oh man, you know, you quote the dude right there. You're just like, oh, I totally see where he's coming from in terms of everything kind of just clicks for him because it's just so like in plain sight, like I said. So I love that point about the philosophy, and it again is like a pretty nice segue into what I wanted to talk about next, my second shot, which is one of the themes of the movie that I didn't notice until this rewatch, but there's just this huge overt theme of war. I apologize if it was like painfully obvious to everybody, but I think I just noticed it for the first time on this watch, starting with the very first scene where Sam Elliott narrates as the stranger, and he's saying the time period of this movie takes place not long after the conflict with Saddam and the Iraqis, which is, you know, obviously alluding to the Persian Gulf War. So this takes place in the early 90s. And then you've got the quote, the infamous quote that Bush Sr., George H.W. Bush, said, where this aggression will not stand, right? Which he said in an interview that he's watching on TV. And then the dude later quotes that, right? He quotes it directly, which is just a hilarious like callback, right? So you have this theme of war, and not just that war. It seems like every war that the United States has participated in since World War II is shouted out at one point during this movie, because yeah, you've got the Big Lebowski, who lost his legs in Korea. You've got Walter, who was a Vietnam veteran and saw his friends die in the muck. And you've got, obviously, the shadow of the specter of this Persian Gulf War kind of, you know, overshadowing, you know, a lot of this movie. And it's called back in the aggression will not stand line and in that first interview with Bush. But there's like a lot of really interesting times throughout this movie where you've got like this whole idea of like xenophobia, especially with these Germans. And I feel like there's something there. There's something there that I might not even be able to like wrap my whole head around without doing like a huge deep dive. But, you know, war causes issue. War causes issue at home, obviously, because all of these people are like very flawed, right? You've got the very capitalistic and selfish Lebowski. You've got Walter, who has his fair share of, you know, arguably he's dealing with some mental health issues due to his time serving in Vietnam. And I think that at large, right, this movie might even be a commentary on the Persian Gulf crisis and how it had like a debilitating effect on the rest of the country, you know, because a lot of people kind of didn't really see the point in that war. Same with a lot of war and a lot of anti-war film and propaganda that has come up throughout the year. That totally is the point, and that's the message. But I think that the Persian Gulf War is very interesting because it's the least talked about, and yet it's prior to you know, the war on terror for us, it's been the most recent war. And it's the last one that was like, you know, just very had a definitive beginning and an end. Mm-hmm. But yet it has had such an interesting effect on both the people that fought in that war and came back as veterans, but then also just, you know, the consciousness, I think, of the nation as a whole. Maybe the dude is a representation of that. But I mean, the amount of war references in this, it can't be a coincidence.
No, I think that's such a great point, because I notice all the references too, but I never really put it together that, you know, the theme aspect of it. And I think that you couldn't have said it better, that, you know, this movie kind of subtly points out all of the effects of war, or some of the effects of war, including the mental health issues that can arise with veterans. And also, like you pointed out, the xenophobia, which is not just displayed with the Germans, like you said, how they show that whole bit, but also there's a whole line of dialogue when they're at the bowling alley towards the beginning, about where the dude references people of Chinese origin, you know, in kind of a political or in a politically incorrect way. And Walter actually corrects him and says that's not politically correct. And so from the very beginning, you get kind of like this tone of, you know, how xenophobia, how racism, how these different things can exist in a society, even with its most liberal members, even with someone like the dude who would probably be considered pretty liberal, like, you know, if we were to guess his political ideology. And so I think that, you know, all of those things kind of, I mean, there's probably a ton of commentary that we could point out in this movie, but I especially think that, you know, your point about the effects of war is such a good point, because that really does bring out, you know, problems at home, including mental health with veterans, the lasting effects of racism and xenophobia, other, you know, issues that I think you're right that the characters themselves can represent in this movie.
Yeah. So tons of stuff to go over here. I mean, that's just like a really surface level analysis. I mean, there's, like we said, this is probably taught in schools, this film, because it's, the themes can be interpreted in so many ways, as many of the best movies often are. So sorry if we didn't quite get as deep as the scholars.
I think that was pretty deep for our podcast. Of
maybe, but that's just your opinion, man. What would you say then would be your third and final shot about the dude and his name counterpart, the Big Lebowski?
So my final shot is going to be about Steve Buscemi and his performance in this movie.
So good. So glad you're going to talk about Buscemi. I love him so much.
So
we haven't talked about him since Desperado.
Yeah, I love him too. And in this movie, I never really noticed before, but he's a huge part of this movie, obviously, because he's in so many scenes. The ending is all, you know, focused around him and his death. But for most of the movie, his character, literally, it's just the scenes with him in it just are consisting of him being told to shut up.
Shut the fuck up, Doc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every scene that he's in, he tries to say something. He tries to add to the conversation between the dude and Walter. He's kind of like that little brother who's trying to butt in on the conversation of his older siblings. or his older friends, and they just hang out with him but won't let him say anything, and he just keeps getting interrupted. And it's funny because I'm like, wow, Buscemi is such a good actor, and this is literally like his role in this movie, is to just keep getting told to shut up and shut up and shut up. But it's like so funny, and it's such a good bit. And then at the end, when, you know, you actually get this kind of really tragic ending where he dies of heart attack, and you know, that is sort of the effect of a unintended consequence of the violence that is and mischief that's been going on with the Big Lebowski and this plot and all that stuff. You know, they unintentionally hurt this innocent man, you know, poor Donnie.
That's another war thing I totally forgot to bring up, is that an innocent bystander is the only one who gets killed, right?
Yes.
Whereas, you know, Walter, who's a veteran and is able to handle himself and take care of his friends, you know, he can't save Donnie. The dude who is just like in the middle of everything and somehow, you know, finesses his way out of every situation, he's somehow okay despite, you know, that one German guy being like, I will fuck you, and just like kung fuing him or something. But Donnie's the casualty, despite him having the least to do with the whole war, if you will.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point, that really ties into the whole theme of the effects of war, the consequences that violence can have on people's lives. And I think at the end, too, you kind of get this sense that the dude and Walter are made to reckon with the fact that they didn't really, you know, listen to Donnie very much, or they just kind of, you know, let Donnie hang around, but maybe they weren't the nicest to him, especially Walter. you know, and they kind of have to think about it for a second, but then, you know, and we'll probably talk about this in the last call, but then they kind of just go back to their ordinary lives because they can't think about it for more than a second because it's too much for them to handle.
Right.
And I think that's such an interesting, you know, I think it's interesting that the movie kind of ends with his character, even though he's sort of a minor character throughout the rest of the movie, but it ends with his death because I think it's kind of, you know, trying to make a point, and this is kind of like your war point where I can't quite put my finger on it yet or can't quite figure out what it is that it's trying to make, but there's definitely something there with the fact that Donnie, who is this person that is continually ignored throughout the movie, ends up being the person who dies and arguably means the most at the end.
Yeah. And Buscemi just, I mean, he's so good in anything, right? He's one of those people that you can stick him in like a bit part or you can have him play a major role and he's going to deliver the same amount of just energy, like neuroticism, and yet just kind of like you can't take your eyes off him kind of energy. And I mean, his range is just incredible, right? This is like, I would put this performance of his like smack dab in the middle between Billy Madison and something like The Sopranos, right? Where full comedy, full drama. This is like something right in the middle where he doesn't get a lot of screen time, but you just kind of totally understand that he's the most normal person. And it's funny because I was talking earlier about how the dude is like representative of an anonymous person, somebody that you know, but you know, he's kind of a collection of all these people that you might know or know of, but Donnie is arguably the most normal person because he has the least skin in the game and he has like absolutely nothing to really add to the mystery or to solving it. He's just kind of there and yet for whatever reason, every time he's there, you're like, oh, well, you know, why is everybody being so mean to this guy? You know, why? He's just asking questions. He's just doing that. But then, you know, at the same time, those people like Walter and the dude characters are, the dude's kind of like irreverent, like indifferent to him, I should say. And the Walter character is just outwardly hostile. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's how, like, I feel like a lot of people who can't really get a grasp on the situation and like read the room and gather context clues, that's how they're treated. Yeah. Like a lot of the time. Right. If you're
kind of like the outcasted friend in the group.
Exactly. Right. And yet he's the one who like suffers the most, which has to be commentary for something. But I mean, the fact that they got Buscemi, who's like at this point a well-known actor, just to come in and do that. I mean, he's notorious for taking really good roles and like being in really good movies, even if he has like nothing to do. And this is just another star to add on his jacket, if you will, to keep the military analogy going.
Maybe it's a message about needing to be better to that one person in your friend group that people are not so nice to or don't always invite to everything.
Yeah. So for my third shot, I just kind of needed to take a minute to compose myself because I was laughing so much during this movie. I always laugh when I watch this movie, but particularly at some of these scenes because this movie is not what I would say a comedy, but it has definitely got dark humor in it. And the first time you watch it, especially if you're in an altered state, I can tell you that the scenes that I'm about to kind of just like describe can definitely be very funny if you're just like watching them at face value because of how absurd they are. If you watch this movie enough times, hopefully you can get past the absurdity of all of these different scenes, right? And realize them for what they are, which is just outstanding cinematography. Incredible like attention to detail, a great like writing and or marriage of like music and soundtrack into the scene. Like it's cinema and it's just that in the best way. It's why this movie is revered, I think, in some ways. Despite not I don't think anyone would ever rank it as the Coens' best movie, but it's definitely one of their most beloved for these scenes I'm about to go into. All right, let's start with my favorite, John Turturro's introduction as Jesus, which is, let me just say, this film is shot by Roger Deakins. Did y'all know that? The GOAT cinematographer shot this movie about fucking bowling and peeing on rugs, you know? When Wu, the hitman Wu in the first scene, quotes Julius Caesar and he says, "Thus always to deadbeats, Lebowski." You know who shot him pissing on Lebowski's rug? Roger Deakins. That's who, all right? And he also shot this scene where Turturro is introduced and Hotel California by the Gypsy Kings is playing and the guy's like licking his bowling ball and then he's wearing this, what can only be described as the most vibrant bowling outfit of all time. It's just this pink and yellow or pink and red jumpsuit, almost purple. And then he just bowls and these shots of the bowling, like, I want to know how they did it. Did they have like this dolly or something? I've never seen any like making of or behind the scenes of how they made this shot, but it's a perfect tracking shot of this bowling ball taking you right into the point of view of like the lane and the bowling ball as it strikes down all the pins, right? It's just absurdity. And then you follow that up with like this amazing scene between the dude, Walter, and Donnie, where all three of them are having completely separate conversations. The dude is talking to Walter about how he theorizes that Bunny kidnapped herself. Walter immediately tunes everyone out and starts talking about how Bunny is a slut or a whore and he didn't go to Vietnam just so she can prance around town, you know, doing all this stuff, not listening. Donnie is completely lost. And all three of these characters are seemingly having a conversation, but they're all within their own worlds because they're all just spouting their own ideologies out, kind of like you said. But then it's undercut by they all have a distaste for John Turturro, who is an even smaller part than Steve Buscemi's role. And he's another person that's just always amazing and has such an incredible range. So I just love that. And like from a cinematic perspective, just the script and the cinematography in that scene is just awesome. I had to watch this movie like four times to get over the fact that this motherfucker was like licking a bowling ball, right? Like the absurdity is almost too much at times. Same thing with the music video partway through the film where, you know, Lebowski's been spiked, has had his drink, his white Russian, his Caucasian spiked by Jackie Treehorn. And he starts to have a trippy dream where he's, you know, in a bowling alley, he sees Maude, he's teaching her how to bowl. It's one of the most famous sequences of the film, right? And it's all set to the song, Just Checked In to See What My Condition Was In, I'm not really sure the artist at this moment. I will put a link to a Spotify of it. I've got it right here. It's by First Edition, the band First Edition. I will link the song on Spotify if you've never seen this film. It's wild. It's trippy. Wikipedia describes it as psychedelic rock, and this is a psychedelic scene, right? Man, just the production of that whole scene was like, it was like a high quality, you know, MTV music video because of just how like wild it is, right?
Kenny Rogers in First Edition.
Kenny Rogers in First Edition? Was he the lead singer? I mean, I know he's like a solo artist too.
It says artist Kenny Rogers, album The First Edition, released 1967. Genre psychedelic pop and country.
Yeah, so that's like awesome. That just adds a whole nother level of awesome. But I mean, everything down to, you know, the set that they built for this, the fact that this is like so well designed as a set for like a trippy dream sequence with only like with completely obscure black. You look like you're in space. The hilarious imagery of Saddam Hussein wearing a bowling employee's outfit and then handing the dude some shoes. God, what else? The freaking weird headpieces that all of Maude's dancers are wearing that look like bowling pins.
Like you said, I mean, even that Saddam thing shows how much the war is on his mind, even in his trippy psychedelic dream state.
Yeah.
Like, shows how much it's on his mind that he's dreaming about that right now.
Yeah.
While he's also dreaming about typical things that people dream about, like this woman that he likes and mm-hmm. these other women and him bowling.
Hobbies.
Yeah.
And he wants...
He's dancing. I love his dance moves. That was something I wrote down is Jeff Bridges. If that's him actually dancing, like, that's awesome and hilarious. Yeah. He has such great dance moves where he, like, comes down the stairs and he's doing the jig.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all really awesome when a star, a movie star, can dance like no one is watching, mm-hmm. because that not only speaks to the star's like charisma on screen, but also the director, if like, you know, to be like, hey, I need you to like do something that you don't ordinarily do. Maybe he does. I mean, you could have fooled me, but let's assume he doesn't, and the Coen brothers got that out of him. That's even awesomer. So. Great filmmaking all around, right? Mm-hmm. And then I think my favorite scene in the whole movie is the dude in front of the sheriff of the Malibu Police Department, who the sheriff himself, like the actor's name escapes me, but he delivers this great monologue where he's like, I don't like, what's the quote? Like, I don't like your jerk off face.
Yeah.
I don't like your jerk off. Attitude, I don't like your jerk off clothes, and I don't like you.
And the dude's like, I know my rights.
Yeah. and then this police chief throws in an act of pure brutality, throws mm-hmm. this coffee cup at the dude's head, and he just goes, ow, fucking fascist. Yeah. That's his reaction. You call him a fascist. It's so absurd, but it's really great because one, that's a really funny monologue and like a great, great line for the script. But I mean, just everything about that scene to come crashing back. It's such a great contrast from the trippy music video, which happens right before it. And then you're suddenly just crashing back to reality. The dude is not liked in the society. Now he's in an even more like elitist society in Malibu, right? And he's just getting like, even the law enforcement, it was one thing to be harassed by a rich private citizen, but to be harassed by, you know, somebody that's supposed to represent the community and the common good. I mean, it just shows you how out of his depth he is and mm-hmm. how he's just kind of, he was set up to fail. But yeah, like I love that scene just because of how absurd and how funny it is. I love all these scenes because of how absurd and how funny they are. But also the filmmaking here is just like really good. That scene at the end is, you know, smash cut to the dude being yelled at and being told to get out of his town, and then smash cut to him in the back of a cab listening to the Eagles, and he fucking hates the Eagles.
You think that he hates the Eagles because they're too mainstream?
Yes, 100%.
That's part of the joke too. Like all these little jokes on his stereotype of a character, like even the fascist comment, like that's something that somebody stereotypically like who, you know, is super liberal and smokes weed would call somebody they don't like, right?
It's a fascist.
Like, so I think it's, like you said, it's especially funny when he says that because you're like, of course, you like that would be the stereotypical thing that they would say that he would say.
What?
And and then, you know, when he's in the car and he's like, oh, the Eagles are too mainstream for me. I fucking hate the Eagles.
What do we know about the dude? He listens to Creedence a lot. He's got like Creedence tapes. Very pro or anti-war band, very associated with the anti-war movement of the 60s against the Vietnam War. And he was a roadie for Metallica, who is like the most, you know, metal, anti-the Eagles kind of band you can get, especially, you know, leading up to 1990, I think, was when the Black Album came out with Enter Sandman and all that, all those really big hits. I mean, you know, Metallica is still... at the top of their game at this point. And I feel like the Eagles is like kind of softer rock is just, yeah, the dude wouldn't like that. Which, shame on him. The Eagles are great. And the Gypsy Kings cover of Hotel California in this movie is top 10.
Now, here's my question. Can you be truly a laid back person, but have such strong viewpoints about music?
I mean,
is that a realm that it doesn't matter? Like you could still, I think that's part of the joke is like, you know, even this like laid back guy, he has very strong viewpoints about that, about obviously important matters like world matters and other things that, you know, and he gets, I think, consistently throughout the movie, even though he's portrayed as this kind of like stoner laid back guy, I would actually argue that throughout the movie, he's actually not very calm. Like, even though he's smoking weed all the time, he's like getting angry, like reasonably so about
and anxious
about, yeah, about a lot of stuff, including, you know, the like this aggression will not stand. He just wants someone to compensate him for his rug. When they don't, he gets mad. Yeah. You know, he gets reasonably upset in other situations where people are treating him badly. So he doesn't just like go about and do nothing. Like, he does get irritated and aggravated throughout, you know. And I think that that's kind of, it's like, it's very interesting. This movie's kind of like his quest to be that kind of laid back guy who isn't involved, so he doesn't have to, you know, face any sort of like confrontation, but he's sort of forced into these confrontational circumstances. And even when he does get sort of confrontational, it's his own version of aggression where he's just like, well, fuck it. That's like his version of aggression. He might raise his voice or ask for them to stop playing the Eagles, but he's not going to, or sit, you know, he gets mad at Walter a lot. And he's just like, what the fuck are you doing, Walter? Like, just shut up while I'm on the phone. Or like, if he's really upset, like, especially with Walter, when he, you know, because the dude really does worry that Bunny is in danger, you know, reasonably so. So he gets mad when he thinks that Walter is interfering with that. And so, you know, he kind of comes out of his drug-induced state multiple times throughout the movie to express his frustration. And, you know, even it's kind of it contrasts to his stereotypical stoner, I guess, mindset. And Walter even points that out when he's like, you're being very undude-like, you know, when the dude is not being very calm. But I think that's part of, you know, the whole movie and the dude's personas, even though he's like this sort of laid back guy who's trying to ultimately not be involved in any sort of confrontations, he gets put in confrontations. And when he is, he does react. And like you said, I think he is sort of an anxious person too. So maybe that's why he smokes weed.
I think so. And I mean, it goes all the way back to what we were talking about at the very beginning with, you know, the dude's personality is the driving, like, most appreciable thing in this movie, because it ties it just like he wants a rug that ties the room together. The dude's character and his like whole, all of his mannerisms and actions throughout this film, they tie this film together.
Yeah.
You know, it's perfect. It's a match made in heaven. So that's it for Triple Shot. My gosh. I feel like we haven't even really gone in on this movie as much as we'd like, but I would really love to go and hear what everybody's thoughts are. We will have ways you can write into the show later on. So until then, let's get into the end of this film, which, you know, is kind of all over the place. And maybe one of the most confounding parts of this whole movie is how it ends. But we're going to get into that here in Last Call. The Last Call, where we discuss the endings of movies, why movies end the way they do, and what we liked about it, what we disliked about it. You know, I'll go ahead and start. I think the ending is not the strongest point of the film, but I mean, how can you end a movie that is predicated on absurdity and just needs to end at some point? Like, the plot has to end, although the spirit of the movie is kind of endless, if that makes sense. You know, so this movie ends with after the scene where they confront the Germans and Donnie dies of a heart attack. So Walter and the dude go to a funeral home to, I guess they have to cremate Donnie. And they are offered a urn. They look at the pricing and they don't want to pay the money for an urn. And the funeral director tells him, like, you know, this is our most modestly priced receptacle. To which Walter says, is there a Ralph's around here? And for those of you guys who don't know, Ralph's, the grocery store, plays a prominent role in this film too.
He's like, just because we're bereaved doesn't mean we're suckers.
Yeah. Or something like that. We're saps.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I think all this, I mean, I think this is just slightly before the like very, very end, but it's a part of the entire like ending after the big main fight, like you said.
It's the epilogue.
Yeah, exactly. And I think all this stuff with Donnie's death is very interesting because like we were talking about early more of the impact of his death and how it's supposed, it is sort of sending a message about this character and him being an innocent in this, all these events and still dying and how tragic that is. And then also you get the many aspects of dark humor that are put in with this movie. Like you said, the funeral jokes about the urn and then his ashes getting all over the dude and like the wind. It's so terrible, but it's yep. just your classic dark humor moments.
And this movie does dark humor better than like almost any movie that is like of this caliber and has this like good of a cast. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't even touch on this is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass, Larry. One of the most memorable scenes of this whole movie, but apparently it's just not even memorable enough to bring up on our podcast. I don't even want to get into it though, because this, if you haven't seen this movie, go watch this movie and I don't want to spoil it for you. If you have seen this movie, you know what the fuck I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. This is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass, Larry. And
kid whose dad is on a machine,
an iron
needs
lung
to breathe. Yeah,
that's some of the best dark comedy.
And he resorts to jacking cars, and it's I think the best dark humor is always somehow tied to social commentary,
rooted in reality.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that this movie just, like, it just keeps hammering it, but it never gets tired. Like, never, I never feel tired of it. It's always funny. And all those scenes of dark humor, and including toward the end, the sort of epilogue where Donnie dies, and then you get, or after Donnie dies, and you get sort of the all the events that occur after he dies. And then, you know, because Walter and the dude sort of need to do something to distract themselves from everything, they just are like, fuck it, let's go bowling, which is what they've been doing throughout the movie. Even, you know, in the most absurd moments when they just, you know, encountered that scene where they threw the money out of the window and were getting shot at, then they just go bowling. It's like the same kind of concept. Their friend just died, but they're like, fuck it, let's go bowling. Right. 'Cause that's like their grasp on trying to sort of, you know, feel like, distract themselves from everything that's going on. So they go bowling. Things are sort of reverting back to normal. And then you get the narrator, played by Sam Elliott, just kind of his interaction with the dude. And then Sam Elliott's kind of little speech about how life is just like one big circle and it just goes on. And it just kind of leaves you with this feeling of like, oh, you know, it's wrapped up. This story is sort of wrapped up with the two beginning and the end.
Take her easy, dude. Take her easy. I've never heard that before or since, but it's brilliant.
Yeah. I think that it was a master move to ask Sam Elliott to do the narration in this movie.
100%.
And they actually show him and have him break the fourth wall.
He breaks the fourth wall. He reveals some plot points about how the dude impregnated Maud and she's with his child now, which is kind of a
little dude,
a minor plot detail that I don't actually know what purpose it ultimately serves other than to just kind of say that at the end and show that Maud is like, you know, a kind of noirish love interest, one that doesn't actually, they don't actually love each other, but she's like the one person that cares about him for a reason, although it's later found out that like, oh, that's a ulterior motive as well.
It's a setup for not only the idea of a Little Lebowski, which they don't actually say it in the movie, but I think it's funny because they talk about Big Lebowski, then they talk about the dude, then you got Little Lebowski. And also for the hilarious line where the dude says to I believe it's DeFino, who's the other private investigator. And he says, "She's not my special lady," in reference to Maude. "She's my fucking lady friend. I'm just helping her conceive, man." And it's like, he says it like, can't somebody just understand that I might just be helping my friend conceive, my fucking lady friend?
Yeah.
And I think it's another stereotypical joke about like super liberal people, is that they'd be willing to do arrangements like that just because, you know, yeah, you can, and you know, why not, and all that. So I think that's a funny joke.
I love that. And I also love the ending narration and the fourth wall breaking that you alluded to earlier, because that's kind of what carries us out of the movie. And then, you know, then credits. And that's basically the end of The Big Lebowski. I mean, it's just peppering in like dark humor, you know, little callbacks, the stranger, Sam Elliott, saying like, "Hey, you got any more of that good sarsaparilla?" You know, just being like ultra Southern, ultra Western, like, you know, cowboy. And I think it ends on a pretty uplifting-ish note. Kind of, it's like a exemplification of like, oh, that life's going to go on. And that's what I meant by like the spirit of this movie is kind of endless, because it's like showing that no matter what, the representations of these people in real life are all going to exist and continue to exist, because there's always going to be people like this in the world. Mm-hmm. They're in a supernatural event. It's Shining-esque how surreal this movie can get somehow, and sometimes in some of the scenes. And that's exactly what I think the Coens are going for in a lot of the stuff. I mean, they like to mix in some supernatural elements here and there, but in ways that feel like, oh, wow, like that's happening to this real life person, as opposed to, you know, it's a adaptation of fiction or something. I mean, it's kind of tough to describe, but the Coens are movie magicians, man. And this is just one of the things that they are really good at. It's why this movie stands the test of time. You know, I think it was added to the Library of Congress National Registry in 2014. Like, it's an American classic, and it should be.
Yeah, and I think the fact that this movie does have kind of like a storybook type ending, where it's like, all right, now we're going to narrate the ending, and like he's talking to kids almost, like Sam Elliott's talking to kids. Yeah, like a fable, kind of is what makes it interesting against this bizarre backdrop of the entire rest of the movie. And
Law's
it's
angles.
A lot like Raising Arizona in many ways, the kind of like bizarre fable. And a lot of their movies are like that. Mm-hmm. So,
Shout out my favorite Coen Brothers film, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which features another great performance by David Huddleston, who plays the Big Lebowski in this movie. I mean, we've already said it a million times. There's only so many ways we can say it, but the cast in this movie is absolutely stacked. Everybody's amazing. We still didn't even talk about Julianne Moore. Let's talk a little bit about her before we end the show, because I just think she's incredible in this movie. I mean, her character is so surrealist, and it's funny because she's an artist, and surrealism is an artistic movement, right?
She's a feminist artist.
Yeah, yeah. She's an artist that paints nude while hanging from a like baluster from the ceiling, or like a cradle from the ceiling, and like paints, just flipping paintbrushes while she gets pushed across the room. Just me describing it is so absurd, but she is so in the pocket of just like, I am this character. I am like, she has this like mid-Atlantic accent that just like cuts through everybody, and it's like, no, even though I'm absurd, I'm more sophisticated and capable than everybody here. And she speaks some Spanish on the phone. Qué ridículo, right? It's just, and I forgot David Thewlis is in this movie. Shout out my Harry Potter fans out there. Like,
and how could we forget Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Flea. Oh, and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Both of them, yeah. I mean, we haven't even talked about Hoffman. He's just so understated in this movie, despite the fact that he does Boogie Nights, where arguably he should have won the Academy Award Best Supporting Actor. He's so freaking good in that. Everybody's amazing. Goodman's amazing. Bridges is amazing. Moore's amazing. The whole cast is, you know, throwing 100 miles an hour fastballs. And it's just like, wow. Like, everybody's just firing on all cylinders. I even Peter Stormare, who plays the German, Carl Hungus. great screen name, great porn name. He's just fully in.
Do you think that the focus of, you know, Bunny Lebowski's feet and her doing her nail polish, we get introduced with that, and then the toe comes back around, is a joke about Tarantino?
You know, it's funny because I was thinking when we were watching it, this is the most Tarantino-esque of the Coen films, I think, because it's set in L.A., which a lot of Tarantino's movies are, and because it's got like some of that, you know, crime elements in it, but set in the modern day. I do think that there's definitely a case to be made for that.
Were any of Tarantino's foot movies came out before this one? I mean, I know Kill Bill is the big one, but that didn't come out till 2003.
Pulp Fiction has some foot shots of Uma.
Oh, yeah, and it's about the feet rubbing joke. Yeah. So this definitely could be a joke about that because, like you said, this movie is the most Tarantino-esque. Like, when you look up The Big Lebowski, one of the first things that comes up on Google is other movies you may like, Pulp Fiction.
Okay? Yeah.
And this, you know, it definitely has that vibe, and I could totally see the focus of that kind of satirized female character being like a double joke, almost like meta joke about the Tarantino foot thing.
Yeah, and this movie, I think, almost, I wouldn't say more, because a lot of the Coen's films have really good original music, right? You know, courtesy of T-Bone Burnett, you know, who's the archivist, I think, on this movie, but in other ones, he's like straight up done the score or, you know, curated the soundtrack. I mean, a lot of them have like really good original music, but the ones that don't often have like really good needle drops, soundtracks, songs that they take from other artists that they just feature in this one, in this movie, The Man and Me, Bob Dylan, obviously like a great needle drop in the very first scene. And that's another thing that Tarantino does a lot is just feature, you know, songs being played usually on like record players or car stereos, because, you know, that's how people consume music before the iPod. That's another thing that shares DNA with this movie. And it's no coincidence that those movies are like related on Google, because they're both really good for a lot of similar reasons. I think that if you were to put them on a spectrum, Pulp Fiction probably, you know, steers more towards like grittier, more realistic crime, less surreal stuff, and more just like kind of compelling, unique situations that could feasibly happen, although like unlikely. But this one is more like, it likes to dip its toes in the bubble bath, the candlelit bubble bath with the joint in hand of the surreal.
I feel like this one could be like on a spectrum in between Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown.
You think
so? Because Jackie Brown is like the extreme example of like almost Tarantino's wanting to do a straight noir.
Yeah.
And then Pulp Fiction is like his really kind of crazy noir. And this one is like sort of in the middle in terms of its like intensity, but there's more jokes in it. Because there's a lot of jokes in Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown. I mean, that's the whole vibe. It's like these 90s movies that have this vibe, they just can't be recreated. Like even Tarantino, I don't feel like could recreate them when he made movies in the 2000s.
Kill Bill,
they're Death still Proof. Really good, but they don't have the same vibe, you know, as his 90s films, I would say.
Yeah.
And I feel like this movie is definitely in the vein of that and some other, you know, 90s movies that were made. Even like when we were talking about Robert Rodriguez's films, were like that era was definitely a reaction where young filmmakers were like, hey, we want to make something new, something fresh. And even though the Coen brothers had been around, you know, made stuff before, I feel like they were still part of this era of like making some movies, because their movies definitely aren't like traditional blockbuster movies, right?
Sure. And like in the 90s, they make crime-esque films, you know, like they make their first film, Blood Simple, which I think is kind of wild, is a neo-noir like crime movie, right? In the same vein as like Pulp Fiction or like Hard Eight, Paul Thomas Anderson's directorial movie,
and
directorial debut. Like they make a lot of these crime noir-ish neo-noirs, like especially in the 90s, because that's like it's like prestige at that time,
right?
You know?
And I think the noir crime thing is definitely what ties them all together, but also just the like absurdist parts of them.
Yeah.
Like the fact that these movies are all kind of ridiculous and absurd, and like
they all have black comedy in
black,
them.
Dark comedy. Yes. And I feel like there are some people who watch these movies and quite frankly are like, this is overrated.
Yeah.
Or they don't quite quote get it or don't like it. And I think that it's either you love these movies or you hate them.
That's just their fucking opinion, man.
Yeah.
God, who would think these movies are overrated?
Yeah.
I now, like, to be fair, the Coens have a long filmography, like a long filmography. It's got a lot of stuff in there that, like, I don't really know if all of them are as good, you know? Like, I mean, to be fair, I haven't seen all of their films that they've directed, nor have I seen all the films that they are that they have written. Like, I haven't seen The Man Who Wasn't There with Billy Bob Thornton. I haven't seen Intolerable Cruelty, and I haven't seen The Lady Killers. You know, and those are all films that are not, you know, at the front of the pack when discussing, you know, their stuff, but it's no coincidence that, you know, Barton Fink, Fargo, Big Lebowski, No Country for Old Men are all like kind of what you associate if you're like a movie fan and you just like think Coen Brothers, that's like the first things that you think of. Those are all kind of like born of that era, you know, even though No Country for Old Men came out 10 years after this one, I think it's the most crime, like it's the most well done crime movie I think of that decade, mm-hmm. period, full stop.
Yeah.
But also like it owes a lot to their
style.
To their style. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think what makes like their crime movies so good and Tarantino's or other kind of directors that are sort of different is, I think, like you were kind of saying with No Country for Old Men, even though it's a lot different than obviously The Big Lebowski, it still has that element of their style and the fact that they're a little weird, like their movies are a little weird and that's what makes them so good. And I guess maybe weird's the wrong word. They're eccentric.
Yeah.
And that they're willing to go and do something different from other filmmakers and do something other than something that other people have done a million times. And that's what makes them unique. And so that's, I think, in the same vein, why The Big Lebowski is so unique, why it's been so enduring, and why people love to, you know, rewatch it.
100%. And I think that, as good as any, should wrap up our discussion.
We went on so many tangents there.
Yeah.
If you're still with us.
If you're still with us. Yeah. Sorry about that. We just love talking about this stuff, man. And sometimes we get really distracted. It's hard, man. But thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed our discussion and are excited for what we're going to be doing next week. Next week, we will be doing an Inspired By episode, the XYZ Cocktail, the film that inspired it. Well, a film that I really wanted to watch again for a long time. I wanted to introduce Marissa to it. It's 2002's Triple X, starring Vin Diesel. And wow. I mean, we've got all kinds of things to say about it. If you heard our Fast and Furious episode, you know we're big Vin fans. But let me just say this one is a completely different breed in my opinion, because Vin is taking center stage completely. Directed by Rob Cohen. We're going to be drinking XYZs because really and truly there's that three letter combination, triple X, XXX, XYZ. It fits so well. So get that ready and get ready for our special guest. We will be having a special guest on the show. Stay tuned for that. And we're going to have a special announcement at the end of next episode. So please stay tuned. And if you want to reach out to us before then, check us out on Apple Podcasts. Leave a review. Give us 5 stars. And if you want to reach out to us more directly, shoot us an email, momixpod@gmail.com. That's momixpod@gmail.com. Or on Instagram and Facebook at momixpod, momixpod. And until next time, Marissa, got anything else to add?
You know, the dude abides. I don't know about you, but I take comfort in that. It's good knowing he's out there, the dude, taking her easy for all us sinners.
Very deep. Oh my God. Jeez, I just want you to narrate my my beer commercials. Thank you for that. That was glorious.
You are welcome.